Hello everyone, welcome to Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. I'm broadcasting at a bit of a higher resolution today, so we'll see how that goes. And let's hope it goes well. This is the penultimate video of the course. It's called A Critical Stance. It's part of Module 8, Ethical Practices in Learning Analytics. And what I'm up to in this particular video is looking at what we mean by ethical practices when we're talking from the perspective of ourselves. And it's going to take us down a few side roads, but I think they're interesting and useful side roads. And when we come out of it, we'll be setting ourselves up for, I think, what really is the best recommendation I can make with respect to ethical practices from the perspective of artificial intelligence and analytics. It's not going to be a set of rules or anything like that, but it is going to be related to the fact that ethics is, for each of us, something very personal. So, with that, let's launch into the presentation. So, I'm going to begin with what I'm calling a concluding unethical postscript. And yes, that's a nod and a wink to Soren Kierkegaard, because it seems to me an awful lot of ethics is based on a bit of a leap of faith. And I want to describe that leap of faith, because really that's where this course has led us. And the concluding unethical postscript that I'm offering here is pretty much a summary of some of the major conclusions of the course. The first and most important conclusion to me is that we can't just talk about the ethics of such and such, for example, the ethics of analytics or the ethics of artificial intelligence, whatever, as though we have solved ethics. We have not solved ethics. We do not have a universally agreed upon or universally substantiated theory of ethics. And many of the debates that we see in our society today are pretty clear evidence of the fact that we haven't solved ethics. If we had solved ethics, ethics and analytics, ethics and AI would be easy. But we haven't. So it's hard. Ethics based on virtue or beneficial outcomes, which we looked at earlier in the course, are simply not going to be satisfactory in the case of fields like learning analytics, if they're satisfactory anywhere. First of all, we don't even agree on what the good is. That's especially the case in education and learning analytics. We don't even agree on what we ought to be accomplishing in ethics, or sorry, in education, in learning analytics. Is it job training? Is it preparation for life? Is it a balanced view of the world? Is it developing capacities of reason and understanding? Is it to create sociable and friendly people? Is it all of these? Is it some of these? Is it none of these? We don't have agreement on that. Even more significantly, we don't know what the consequences of a lot of these technologies will be. When we, and I say we because I was implicated to some degree in this, when we created the internet, we didn't know that one of its primary uses would be to share cat pictures. We didn't know that a social network called Facebook would use an algorithm that prioritized engagement for advertising purposes, creating a proliferation of fake news and political conflict. When we don't know what the consequences are going to be, it's pretty hard to base your ethics on consequences. Especially when you can't repair the bad consequences after the fact. There are, you know, results of some of the things that we do that can't be fixed. If we blow up the world somehow, you know, there's no coming back from that. If we prevent ourselves from being able to understand climate change, or how the democratic system works, or what you need to do to fight a pandemic, you can't come back from that. hundreds of thousands, millions of people have died over the last few years based at least partially on misinformation. We can't fix that. They're gone. A lot of people recommend duties or social contracts or documents like codes of ethics just because we can't predict these consequences. But these are blunt instruments used for a task that requires considerable precision. Ethical principles, social contracts, codes of ethics don't take into account context, don't take into account particular situations, don't take into account the lived experience of people who are either ethical actors or the targets of ethical or non-ethical action. They don't take into account the larger interconnected environment in which we live. Many of them don't even grant large parts of that environment standing as ethical values or vehicles. It wasn't so long ago, not so long ago at all, that we had debates on whether women are persons. And yet many of the ethical principles that we've came up with in the past were drafted before we thought of women as persons. Seems odd and wrong. They also don't take into account how analytics themselves work. You can't simply take a rule and apply it to a neural network. That's not how a neural network works. You can sort of maybe put rules around the outside of a neural network application, but when we're actually getting to the core of what the neural network itself is doing, there are so many decisions that are made. We looked at a whole bunch of them, and so many factors and so many data points that it makes no sense to apply simple and universal rules, principles, or codes of ethics to it. It just doesn't, this approach just doesn't respect the subject matter in this case. And interestingly, I sometimes think of efforts to promote ethics in analytics and artificial intelligence as attempts to create an ethical behavior when we ourselves do not behave in that way. We know that the decisions or the output created from these neural network systems reflects the input, and that input is us. As Michael Wish says, the machine is us. And we might not like what we do as a whole. Look at the way society works. We might not like how that works. And it seems a little bit illegitimate to say, well, we really don't like how we are ethically as a species. So what we'll do is we'll come up with some sort of idealized version of what that ethics should be and put that on top of our artificial intelligence so that whatever comes out of it is somehow filtered to produce only the ethical things that we did and not the unethical things that we did. But it's not reasonable to attempt to do that. It's not, I don't know if it's not possible. Maybe it's possible, but I can't imagine how it could be done without creating an artificial intelligence, something like a general artificial intelligence, because there are so many variables and so many factors, that is raised or trained in a completely ethical environment, whatever that might look like. I think, for better or for worse, the ethics of our artificial intelligence and learning analytics systems is going to be the ethics that we show these systems. If we want more ethical AI, we have to be a more ethical society. There isn't going to be some kind of shortcut to that process. This does lead me to explore things like the duty of care. Now, I kind of bracket out the concept of duty here because I don't think We're talking about duty in the sense of a Kantian duty or a moral imperative, a rule based on reason. I'm pretty sure that's not what feminist philosophical perspectives lead us toward. The duty of care is a more relational and more context-bound approach toward morality and decision-making. It's based on different things. We don't pick one thing, like, say, rights or fairness or justice or some abstract principle and say, this will define what our morality is. It's rather based on, as I mentioned before, lived experience, compassion, the feelings of care that you might have, say, toward a child or toward somebody you're responsible for. And it isn't a rigid set of principles. It's rather applied on a case-by-case basis, not as an algorithm or a function, but more like an attitude or an approach. You approach these subjects with care. That's what it means, right? And if you try to cash out what we mean as care in some kind of universal principle that applies to everyone all the time, these efforts will not work, because that's not the kind of thing care is. To care specifically attends to the relationship between yourself and the person you are caring for, or the animal, or the planet, or the society, or whatever. It relates specifically to that relationship and brings in all the variables and all the properties and the entire context of that relationship. And then you kind of feel your way to what would constitute care. And that sounds really hand-wavy, but I think it's a lot less hand-wavy than saying all ethics is derived from a principle of fairness. To me, that's the hand-wavy thing. So what does that tell us? Here's what it tells me. Ethics are, in the end, derived from our own lived experiences. And for AI and analytics, the ethics that they display will be derived from their, quote-unquote, lived experiences. All the decisions, all the input, all the data, the totality of the input, the totality of the context will create whatever ethics is displayed by an artificial intelligence or analytics engine. It's very often a matter of a community as a whole, as an entire system, rather than one individual defining what ethics are. And we're going to need to be a bit careful about this. And in the slides to follow, I'm going to be a bit careful about this. But it's not, you know, ethics as reasoned out by the rational individual completely as one and, you know, in isolation from the rest of the world. It's not that. The entire community plays a role here. And as a result, we need to keep in mind how we're all connected. Now, big surprise, Stephen Downes says we need to keep in mind how we're all connected. But this is important because this is what tells us how we learn to be ethical in the first place. Because for better or worse, we all do learn to be ethical, whatever that means. Some people don't learn very well and become psychotic and have no ethical bone in their body. Other people become really ethical and become saints in society. And most of us fall somewhere in between. Generally, I would say, on the more ethical side of things. But, you know, it's a range, right? But each one of us learns from our experience, from our interactions with other people in the community, what we think ethical is. And we need to talk about how this comes to be. And the other thing is, when we learn what ethics is, it's not that we're learning a set of principles, the way we might learn about Newton's three laws or Einstein's principle of relativity. It's like our knowledge of the world around us, even the physics of the world around us, right? Generally, we learn as a result of observing specific instances, and then our mind, which is a terrific recognition engine, a terrific device that spots regularities, says, oh, you let stuff go, they fall, it always falls, right? Somebody does such and such a thing, the reaction from the community is always pretty negative. But it's a large number, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of individual actions that all combine to feed our own neural nets that give us an understanding of what ethics is. In the same way we train artificial neural networks. The big difference between us and the artificial neural network is that we bring in a lot more experience, we have many more data points to work with, and a much more sophisticated recognition engine. And then there may be properties related to our physical constitution, our genetics, our heritage, which also play a role in how we manage all of that data. I also drew out some suggestions, this is now just in the preceding few sections of this module, of how ethics should be approached in practice, in learning, in a workplace, and in society. Because of what I've observed so far, because of what we've said about ethics so far, rather than creating an emphasis on creating and following rules, it makes more sense to focus on creating an ethical culture. Identify what are the prevailing ethics, if any, there are in a learning environment, in a workplace or whatever, but also recognizing that there's a diversity of perspectives on ethics, and this gives us a wider sense of community where one of the things that we do is exchange opinions on this wider set of perspectives. And this requires, and I talked about this, an encouragement of openness and interaction through a wide range of activities, art, drama, sports, etc., to develop empathy and to develop a capacity to see how ethics might play out from the perspective of another person. This is all, this is not unique to ethics. These are approaches to learning that I think are valuable generally. And I've talked about that in other contexts. But now we're looking at ourselves. What should our ethical practices be? What would inform our ethical practices? How do we even come to know our ethical practices? And we need to start by asking, what do we think ourself actually is? How do we define ourselves? There are different ways that people have of defining who they are or what they are. And this varies from time to time, from society to society, from individual to individual. I've listed six common ways of defining what the self is, and there are many others, but these are major ones. We could think of self as the pure subject of experiences. And putting my cards on the table, this is mostly what I think the self is. I think the self is the set of experiences that constitutes the self. I know it sounds a little circular, but if you have nothing else but experiences, what do? But a lot of people think of the physical existence as an essential component of self. And so they depict self as continuing physical existence. Some people, including some of my connectionist friends, who see the idea of self as possibly extending beyond the physical body and therefore extending beyond conscious experience, might view self as a self-contained network. Others, more pragmatic in nature, see self as a function or a role. This can be really narrow, right? Thinking of the self as a cog in the workplace machine. Or it can be broader, thinking of the self as a rational agent who has the duty to reach ethical conclusions is a depiction of self as a role, in my view. We could think of the self as a set of intersectional identities, and we see a lot of writing along those lines in the current context. So me as intersectional identities, I am male. I am old, reasonably old. I speak English. I'm cisgendered. I'm white or pale pink. I live in Canada. You see all these intersecting different identities, and so the self could be thought of as the totality of all of those. Or the self could be thought of as a set of memories. Either on the one hand, my current set of memories of myself, or on the other hand, of myself as others perceive me and remember me, and which allows me to continue as a self after my physical existence has ended. Many different ways of thinking about self, and as a result, many different ways of thinking about how we come to know things about ourselves. For example, what we consider right, what we consider wrong, what we consider just, what we consider unjust, or fair and unfair, or ew and eh. Many different ways of expressing this. A lot of the discussion in recent years has focused around what might be called the social construction of self. And I refer to, for example, Alistair MacIntyre's work After Virtue, which offers a constructionist point of view. It's also summarized in Ken Gergen's article. And even, aspects of our self, like gender, can be thought of as socially constructed. Consider Simone de Beauvoir looking at selfdom and realizing, well, men have claimed selfdom for themselves, which leaves women left out of even the possibility of having a self. Hence, the second sex, right? The second type of self, the second type of identity. And when we look at it that way, then all of these different ways of looking at self can be thought of as not inherently the case, but something that we have socially constructed, that are, as MacIntyre says, culturally and historically situated. One's conception of self, and indeed one's moral integrity, he writes, emerges from one's narrative of self. Now, bracket, narrative is a very specific way of describing a representation in language using physical symbols, but we could broaden that out, right? It doesn't have to be a narrative, it could be any kind of representational system. Gergen says, when a fundamental distinction between self and other is established, which is what we do with our words, our pronouns, the way we interact with each other, then the social world is constituted in terms of differences. We don't see ourselves all as part of one thing. We see ourselves according to the way we're different from each other. But we're not inherently different from each other. It's just the way our representation of self has been constructed. Now, there's a lot of validity to that. There's a lot of validity to social constructionism, generally. And a significant number of the concepts that we have about the self, and therefore about ethics, can be thought of as socially constructed. Hence Kai Nielsen writing about, quote, inventing right and wrong. Drawing a little more from the feminist approach, we can also go back to Lev Vygotsky and even Ludwig Wittgenstein and talk about self as defined in terms of the relation to others. What is a relational identity? Well, here is just a study on, quote, youth's perspectives on their relational identity development through residential treatment. The relational identity is defined as being authentic and real, being vulnerable, acceptance, empathy, honesty, accountability, gratitude, and humor. These are different ways, and maybe here, virtuous ways, of relating with others. But the idea is that it's an alternative, as Gergen says, to the dominant conception of mind independent from social processes. For Vygotsky, individuals are inextricably related, bound to each other and to their physical surrounds. You know, and it raises the question, even, whether we could even eliminate the self entirely from language. And just think of that as a mental exercise, right? Instead of saying, I'm hungry, just say, hunger. Instead of saying, I'm thirsty, just say, thirsty. Drink. Walk to store. You don't literally need a noun in a sentence. The whole subject, predicate, object construction that we've developed in language is a social construction and to a large degree an artificial construction. Now, a lot of philosophers say that social construction language is also how we think, right? The structure of language is the structure of cognition. That is where I disagree with them. But I don't disagree that language is a social construction. I mean, what else could it be, right? Something we're born with? Well, Noam Chomsky would say that, but I don't think really anyone else is saying that. So that leaves us with some roots. If we take the critical approach, which I've classified here as critical pedagogy, based on something like social constructionism, something like the recognition that these categories of right and wrong, good and bad, just and unjust, etc., are social constructions, and indeed our understanding of self, who we are, what we are based on social constructions, then there are two major routes that we could follow. There's probably not all and only these two routes, but these are the two routes that I see in the literature most often followed. And the route most often followed, especially in the field of ethics, in learning analytics and AI, is the route of social activism. The route that I'm going to follow, while not dismissing the root of social activism, is the root of personal reflection. But let's look at the social activist route first. And we'll see how, at least again in my mind, how that brings us to a root of personal reflection. So, like I said, nobody agrees on the purpose of education, right? It's a socially constructed thing. So let's go back to the purpose of education. James Baldwin, remember James Baldwin, he writes, the purpose of education, finally, is to create in a person the ability to look at the world for himself. Remember, because the men have claimed personhood for themselves. Look at the world for himself to make his own decision. He also notes, no society is really anxious to have that kind of person around. And, you know, that really does raise the question of, you know, does education really want us to be the ones making these decisions, coming to these conclusions about, say, what is right and wrong for ourselves? A lot of people say, yeah, that's what we want. We want the rational person in order to make ethical judgments. But in practice, maybe not so much. Bell Hooks, Teaching to Transgress. She urges teachers to contemplate, quote, education as the practice of freedom, as the point of departure for praxis, a phrase originating from the work of Paulo Freire. And so what we have here is an approach to education that isn't simply a capacity-building approach, but also an approach that has us bring a lot of ourselves into the practice. Now, I have zero problem with that, right? But we need to keep in mind that, you know, it's not the same thing exactly to say that education is an activist discipline promoting, say, diversity, inclusion, and equity, and we're teaching people to make their own decisions. People aren't making their own decisions if we're telling them what their conclusions are. I'm not disagreeing that what is being recommended here is a pretty good path, and indeed a path I myself have taken. I'm just pointing out the tension in the way we approach this. Whoops, wrong way. And that's where care comes in, right? That's where care becomes something like, look, we're not just about indoctrinating these people. Bell Hooks again. To teach in a manner that respects and cares for the souls of our students is essential if we are to provide the necessary conditions where learning can most deeply and immediately begin. And that works out to something like self-actualization, which is great, but then that works out to sacrificing privilege, which may also be great, but may also be viewed negatively by the person in question. And then that, in turn, means to immerse yourself in the work of as many POC, person of color, feminist, activist, and academic writers, bloggers, podcasters, and tweeters as possible, as at least as represented by Julie Fellmeyer. Now, that's not a bad thing, but it's not necessarily a thing I would recommend to everyone, would I? Because it's not clear to me that all of society needs to have this particular perspective. In fact, this particular perspective is more valuable to us when there are other perspectives that it plays off against. And that seems like an odd thing to say, you know. But, you know, it's also a very old thing to say, you know. You can't really understand what freedom is unless you understand what being unfree is. You can't understand justice without understanding what injustice is. All of these concepts, especially all of these ethical concepts, aren't just things that stand on their own. They're things that stand in opposition to something else. And so, a lot of what we have to teach about how we understand what is ethical also involves teaching what is unethical. And if insofar as teaching means experience, it's going to mean at least to some degree even the experience of the unethical. I don't like it. It's like, you have to understand pain to understand what health is. Kind of true. With no, people who don't feel pain at all are actually in a worse situation than people who do feel pain. I'm still not a fan of pain. Totally not a fan of pain, but it plays a role. And this brings us back to the self and identity and who we are and what we are and the role we play. Hooks writes, "Education as the practice of freedom will come easiest to those of us who believe that our work is not merely to share information, but to share in the intellectual and spiritual growth of our students." That's kind of a hard sentence to get at. I can see the practical implementation of it in things like the FemEd quilt, in things like Black Lives Matter, in things like I Don't Know More, the actual taking up of a cause, a form of activism, and making that a part of your teaching practice. And again, I got no problem with that. I think more people should do it. But the doing of it here is reflected not in the student becoming, mini me, who believes all and only the same things I do. The doing of it here becomes the student having intellectual and perhaps spiritual growth. I'm not so keen on the spiritual growth part, but I get that it's important to a lot of people. To, oops, wrong way again. I recommend people go back to Ian Hacking's 1999 work, The Social Construction of What? Because I think he's really pulled off a good overview of what's going on in social constructionism generally. And basically, he identifies four major steps. In the first step, step zero, there is something in the present state of affairs, which we'll call X, that is taken for granted and appears to be inevitable. A marriage is between a man and a woman, for example, or there are two genders, male and female, or the world is divided into black, white, Hispanic, and Asian. These things appear inevitable. We are individuals separated at birth from everyone else. You pick your thing, right? You could apply this to almost anything. And Hacking lists a large list of well-referenced accounts of social construction of this, social construction of that. The constructionist move, if you will, is to say that X, whatever it is, need not have existed or need not be what it is. In other words, X, as it is at present, is not determined by the nature of things. It's not inevitable. We divide ourselves between the self and the other through the way we've structured our language and our pronouns, especially. I refers to me, you refers to you, and we always either use a noun or a pronoun, otherwise our sentences don't make sense. But it didn't have to be that way. We could have, as Star Trek suggests, communicated entirely in metaphors. When the wall falls, shaka, when the walls fell. We could have communicated entirely in pictures that don't have subject and object. All kinds of ways we could have done it. And if we had done it differently, we would not regard ourselves as fundamentally independent of and separate from other people or society as a whole. And here, when I say that, I'm speaking from a Western perspective, fully aware that there are some societies already existing on Earth where that sense of separation isn't nearly as significant as the one that I feel. And this applies to ethical distinctions that we make as well. We divide our actions into those actions that are fair and those actions that are unfair. And we could say, for example, that giving a person special treatment is unfair. Well, we didn't have to define fair and unfair that way. And in fact, there are many reasons why we wouldn't. And so it becomes a matter of argumentation whether the definition of fair means giving people special treatment or giving people equitable treatment or actually making up for unfairness that may have existed in the past. Big discussion to have here, right? But there's no inherently right sense of what it means to be fair. That's why Rawls, for all his good intentions, was really engaged, in my view, in a constructionist project. He imagined a world and then engaged in an act of world building, following perhaps Nelson Goodman's book, Ways of World Making. The third step, once you've recognized that things don't have to be that way, is to say that the way it is, or the way it's thought of, is quite bad. Harm is caused by it, perhaps we might say. Or it's unjust, perhaps we might say. You know, what we count as quite bad varies quite a lot in these accounts, but still. And so, for example, when we say, there are two genders, male, female, that's it. We say, looking at the existence of gays, lesbians, trans, questioning, etc., we say, well, that way of looking at things isn't the right way of looking at things. And the system of pronouns that we have is inadequate to take into account this wide range of genders. And, you know, and again, if our pronouns are just simply the way we agree to talk to each other, which pretty much that's what they are, then you can see how you could make the case that current pronoun use is bad, we should change our pronoun use. And that's what leads us to the third point. We would be much better off if X were done away with, this male, female, all and only male, all and only female, or, you know, dividing the world into black and white, whatever, right? A particular definition of justice, fairness, goodness, badness, good consequences, bad consequences. Pick your moral category, pick your moral value. And we could do this with any moral category, any moral value. You know, show how it was constructed, show how the current construction is bad, show how we could make it that much better. Could do that. Absolutely could do that. And in fact, society, taken as a whole, taken as the sum total of all the interactions that we have with each other and the objects that we create and the objects' interactions with them and ourselves and all of that through time, through history, that's exactly what we've done. We've constructed these things. Maybe not intentionally, maybe intentionally, it varies, but we've constructed these things. And so the argument goes, in order to be better, whatever better means, we should construct it differently. And then we have a conversation, right? That's the way it works. We have a conversation. And then society comes to a consensus, except it never comes to a consensus. And that's the problem. It never comes to a consensus. We come pretty close, right, in some cases. Generally, we think cannibalism is bad. Yeah, there's some exceptions, maybe. But generally, it's a no-go. Although maybe if we discovered today a tribe of beings, of humans, that was completely cut off from the rest of the world, and incidentally were cannibalist, our desire to allow them to lead their lives naturally, you know, uninterfered by the rest of us, as with the original inhabitants of the Andaman Islands, might outweigh our desire to eliminate all cannibalism from the world. I don't know. I don't know how that would play out. Happily, it hasn't come up. But I think, you know, ask 100 people, we'd get many different answers of how we should approach such a situation. This thing, though, this idea that we basically construct the world is incredibly powerful. I learned about it, interestingly, first, reading the work of Lao Tzu, reading about the yin and the yang, right? Reading about how all the differences that we make, light and dark, good and bad, valuable and not valuable, are interpretations that we bring to the world, however the world might happen to be. And it's an intuition, I think, that, you know, appeals to a lot of people and can be appealing. Take, for example, a ball of wax. This ball of wax, if you're wondering, it's the result of me mashing baby bell coatings over the course of several weeks, and then trying to cut it with a string. It is neither good nor bad. It is not inherently good. It is not inherently bad. And you think, well, yeah, it's a baby bell. Who cares? Or just baby bell wax. Well, I thought about that, you know, and I thought, well, maybe baby bell wax has an environmental cost and I should reduce my consumption of baby bell. I don't know. But more to the point, things that we do think are bad, like volcanoes and tigers and earthquakes and floods, aren't inherently good or bad. They're good and bad because that's how we interpret them. We interpret them that way pretty naturally. Right? You know, I mean, volcano's going to kill you. Yeah, you're going to have a negative reaction to that. But it's not because the volcano is bad. We don't think. I mean, I guess there were societies who thought that. Maybe people still think that. But I think today we don't ascribe moral agency to the volcano. It just is. And the badness is the way it interacts with us. Namely, it kills us. And this is where David Chalmers, the last of the great constructionists, comes in. Once you recognize the role that the mind plays in investing things with meaning and with reality, because really that's what we're doing, right? Then it's easier to invest virtual things with meaning, just as much as one can invest physical things with meaning. And that's where we're getting our idea of ethical or unethical AI. And the AI just is, right? I mean, it's the classic, you know, complex counterpart to the volcano, right? The AI just is. It's not inherently good. It's not inherently bad. It is our relation to the AI that leads us to interpret it as good or bad. Take something an AI might do, and I've used this example before. We might use surveillance in order to gather data to train the AI. And in the media today, we're reading over and over, surveillance is bad, surveillance is bad. Surveillance is bad, perhaps, in some contexts, but I can give you a whole bunch of examples where surveillance is good. For example, if somebody is in the process of robbing me at gunpoint, surveillance is good because that might lead a police officer to stop this person from robbing me at gunpoint. Or if somebody is embezzling money from the government by skimming off the top of transactions and hiding the money in Panama, surveillance is good because this person is stealing from society. You get my point, right? The goodness or badness of AI, of a particular action of AI, is based on our interpretation of the goodness or badness of the AI. Now, there's two things that are going to come out of that. One is, we need to ask, where does our interpretation of the goodness or badness come from? And the other thing is this reflected in some way in the AI? And the second thing I think we've already answered in depth, and the answer to that is yes, right? Our ethical judgments, the ones we actually make, are the ones that get reflected in a non-sentient manner through AI, right? If our AI is unethical, it's because we are unethical. No two ways around that. And so the question is, well, what does it mean to say we are ethical or unethical at all, right? Nothing to do with rules. It's based on a construction, but why would we construct it this way rather than that way? Well, I tend to turn in matters of social construction to people like Wittgenstein. Now, Wittgenstein did an exhaustive study of language, but I think his exhaustive study is going to apply to pretty much any social construction. It's just language is a paradigm case of that. And he said a bunch of useful things about language. For example, if we ask about the meaning of a sentence or the meaning of a word, right, Wittgenstein says simply, meaning is use. What a word means is equivalent to how we use the word. There isn't something separate over and above the use of the word, that is, the meaning of the word. And even more significantly, at least to my mind, there's nothing inherent in the word, that is, its meaning. The meaning of the word is, in fact, completely external to the word. Semiotics people probably wouldn't like that description of it, because, you know, you have to have a sign which signifies something, and that's where the meaning comes from. But the signification isn't in the sign. It is in us, and specifically in the use of that sign by us. And so, language taken as a whole really is the sum total of all of our actions related to language. Or, as Wittgenstein says, to imagine a language means to imagine a form of life. It's a way of being in the world. Mollenhauer describes it: we embody and exemplify a way of living to children and young people. We perform a tacit affirmation of certain values, arrangements, and relationships. And language and sports and music appreciation, etc. Right? It's not just ethics. It's all of these socially constructed artifacts. And I think that is, to a large degree, true. I don't think that that's the whole story, because if that is the whole story, then ethics, like language, is purely a social phenomenon. And indeed, if you read Kripke's interpretation of Wittgenstein on rules and private language, he has Wittgenstein advancing a skeptical argument to the effect that language isn't something that's in our head, It's only in society. Now, strictly speaking, that's true. We don't have language in our head. But also, strictly speaking, we can have language in our head every time we imagine somebody saying something or singing something or writing something. We have language in our head. But it's language as an experience as opposed to language as language. That's a tough sentence. I won't expand on that, but that's a tough sentence, and I recognize that. So, how do we end up embodying and exemplifying a way of living? Is it all based on our exposure to culture? I remember having discussions with Rose Grozdanik many years ago, raising the question, you know, do all the things that I think about come from culture? Do all the things that I think about come from TV and radio and books and newspapers and people talking to me? And where is the me in that? And that's a really good question. And I think that, you know, if we're describing sources or causes of our sentiments and our feelings, our knowledge of language, our knowledge of ethics, then we could include all of the experiences of culture that we've had in our life, in our lives, as sources and causes of that, but not just those, because we're exposed to many other things. I am exposed to trees. A tree is not a cultural phenomenon. Although, identifying a tree as a tree qua tree, you know, using the sign tree to represent that physical object, that is a cultural phenomenon. But arguably, the tree itself isn't a cultural phenomenon, unless it was planted in a certain way. It gets rough, right? But, you know, there are things like volcanoes and earthquakes and the ocean and birds. These aren't cultural creations properly so-called. Presumably, they have an independent existence over and above culture. At least, that's what our experiences of them appear to be, even though our experiences of them are heavily filtered through this cultural filter. So how are we going to talk about that? Well, here's where I go to Hume's moral philosophy, because I might talk about the causes of all of these things, the causes of my knowledge of language, the causes of my feelings about ethics, right? But that's distinct from my experience of these things, right? I have an experience of language, I have an experience of ethics. I have an experience of lots of things. I have an experience of phones. I have an experience of lenses. I'm not currently having an experience of a lens cap because I've lost it. Oh no, that's not it. These, to me, are sensations. Experiences, sensations, broadly conceived. We can call these the passions. Now, when Hume says passions, he doesn't mean passion as in, he means passions as anything that isn't based in pure reason. The passions are the senses plus the sentiments, you know, our feeling of inertia, our feeling of disquiet, you know, fear, trembling, whatever. All of these are the passions, right? So Hume's first point is, and I think I've made this point before, but I'll make it again, reason alone cannot be a motive to the will, but rather is, quote, slave of the passions. All right? So what that means is our actions are not based on reason, certainly not on reason alone, but are rather based on the passions. Our senses, our experiences, our hopes, our fears, our desires, all of these non-reasonable things. That's what's in control. Certainly a lot of people would say, well, we should have reason in control, but then you get Mr. Spock of Star Trek. And I think that show has effectively critiqued that concept. Second point he makes is moral distinctions are not derived from reason. By moral distinctions, you know, the distinction between good and bad, fair and unfair, just and unjust, right and wrong, etc. They're not derived from reasons. Rather, these distinctions in ourselves, remember, are derived from the moral sentiments. And now he has a story here. It need not be a 100% accurate story, but it's good enough, right? The moral sentiments are our feelings of approval, which might be reflected in esteem or praise, and disapproval, which might be expressed as blame, felt by spectators who contemplate a character trait or action. So there we are. We're out there in the world. We see somebody kick a cat. We have a feeling of revulsion about somebody kicking a cat. But this feeling of revulsion comes from perhaps our natural sense that people shouldn't kick cats, but also from our exposure to the revulsion of many other people who have expressed revulsion at the kicking of a cat. Yeah, somebody kicks a cat and somebody else says, no, don't do that. That's revolting. And, you know, over time, we acquire that feeling as well. Doesn't mean there's a general moral principle, you should not kick a cat, although I think there should be. What it means is we have acquired the feeling that of revulsion with respect to kicking cats. It doesn't even mean that there is a genuine right or wrong to kicking a cat. I haven't suddenly been granted unique view into reality. You know, it's like I see a person kicking a cat. I can still be skeptical about what I saw. Maybe I saw a projection of a person kicking a cat. Maybe I thought I saw somebody kicking a cat, but it was just the perspective. You know, maybe, well, I was going to say maybe the cat wanted to be kicked, but let's not go there. You know, there's questions I could ask about the veracity of my senses. Similarly, there are questions that could be asked about the veracity of my moral judgment. And indeed, I would argue, there is no answer to those questions ultimately, right? There is no answer to the question, is it right or wrong to kick a cat, right? But what I can say is, I really don't like it when I see it. And that is, at least in part, derived from the fact that other people around me really don't like it when they see it. Doesn't mean we have some sort of unique perspective into the nature of morality. It's just that among us, we generally agree, kicking cats, bad thing. And so that's why Hume says in point four, some of these virtues and vices, in other words, some of these distinctions are natural, like for example, and this is where the whole consequentialist moral philosophy comes from, it's arguable that naturally we find things that are painful to be wrong and things that are not painful to be right, or at least not wrong. But others, including justice and many others, are artificial. So it's interesting, Hume has built in naturalism and constructionism in practically the same sentence. But it doesn't really matter which ones of these are natural and which ones of these are artificial, because from our perspective, they're all coming from the same place. The question of whether they're natural or artificial is a question of studying the causes of these sentiments. It's an empirical investigation. And maybe it might turn out that, you know, we are naturally disinclined to, or naturally inclined to dislike, volcanoes. I think of pretty good reasons for that. Also, we're naturally inclined to think that volcanoes are evil. Pretty good reasons for that. But the sensation of thinking a volcano is evil is similar and felt the same as the sensation that kicking a cat is evil. And it really doesn't matter where it came from. It's what I've got now, right? This is what I think is right. This is what I think is wrong. And what's really important here is everybody has different experiences. No person has exactly the same exposure to culture as anybody else. No person has exactly the same exposure to the natural world as anyone else. There are many differences in our physical construction, including, for example, the difference between being genetically male and genetically female, which may cause us to experience ethics and morality differently, or may not. This is an empirical question, but it doesn't matter because simply experiencing it doesn't mean we have some sort of special access to the truth, assuming that there is a truth in this question, and I don't think there is. So where does that leave us? It leaves us to a view of ethics that is based on a concept of moral sentiment. In other words, an ethics that is basically learned through experience. Not as general principles, not as theories, not even as large representational schemes or moral models or social contracts or any of that, but point by point by point experience. And these experiences are often experienced at a sub-symbolic level. And what I mean by that is, when we look at the world, we don't see the sentence, Fred kicked a cat, right? That's an interpretation. What comes into our head is just a bunch of neural stimulations. And so it might go through our head from beginning to end, right? From the actual sensation of something to the actual feeling that something is wrong, and never be represented by words or sentences at all in our head. In fact, I think most words do that. So it's not a subject of rationality, at least not in the Kantian sense, not in the sense of premises and conclusions and axioms and inferences and representational systems. You could argue that it's a matter of rationality, but now the rationality that we're talking about is a recognition of probabilities and similarities based on patterns in billions of individual variables. The way a neural network does, right? And so how we react in a particular case, and this is important and this brings us back to the ethics of care, is the result of these multiple simultaneous factors. When we look at somebody kick a cat, we think about how the cat must feel because we have this kind of projection of cat-like senses, whatever our projection is. We think about times we were kicked. We think about wider cases where random violence resulted in bad things. We think of the times other people have said, you should never kick a cat. And maybe that significant moment in our childhood where our father looked down on us and said, you never kick a cat. Really significant experience, but not one that everyone has, right? And that's how we react in the particular case. We react in the particular case in a certain way because of the background, because of the experiences that we've had. And we can classify some of the factors related to how we react as ethical factors. So that leaves us with an environment, a world, where we will not have agreement on ethics. We might have broad areas of overlap. We certainly have activism, which is an effort to influence the experiences that we have. But even those who are involved in activism, I think, are aware that, you know, it's one thing to be activist, it's another thing to be a propagandist, it's another thing to exercise mind control, right? And there's the sense, I think, on the part of most activists that the decisions that people make, the experiences that people have, and the actions that they undertake ought to be free and not controlled by the activists. Now, again, depending on your background, you might vary in this inclination. Fascists tend to want to have more control over how you react morally than, I was going to say libertarians, but they seem to want to control how you react morally as well. So I'll say non-fascists. So the ethical practices from the perspective of ourselves has to take this as the starting point. The starting point is there are no universal ethical values, but I'm stuck, and we could say it that way, I'm stuck with this ethical sense. I'm stuck with moral sentiment. I am going to react to events in the world from the perspective of they are right and they are wrong. Some of these reactions will be based on culture. Some of these reactions may be based on my nature, although probably not many of them. Some of them will be based on context. Some of them, perhaps a lot of them, will be based on my relation with other people, what I know about other people, etc. All kinds of factors are going to come into play. But in the end, my moral sensation just is what it is. I feel what I feel. I see what I see. Doesn't mean that I have some access to the ultimate nature of the world. It's just I see what I see, I feel what I feel. And that's what the starting point has to be. It sounds like an impossible case, doesn't it? But I think if we can get to this point, all I need is one video, one part of a module to get us toward ethical practices in a general sense, not just with respect to artificial intelligence and analytics, but definitely with respect to that. So I'm going to leave the video here. One more video to go where I talk about a practice of ethics for an individual in a world where there is no ultimate truth about ethics. Talk to you then. I'm Stephen Downs. Thank you.